Accession number 210019, Reel 3.
Jack Sinclair, Reel 3.
I'd never been with a commando unit before, and I was most surprised to find how many people turned up to say goodbye to the unit. But normally, the unit just went to the trains and went off, but this time it was full of people milling around, all saying their goodbyes to the troops. And of course, I'm a complete stranger to the whole of these. Now, they're all in their camouflage jackets, Jennison smocks as they used to be called, and I'm still in my best battle dress with my chevrons still whitened as they always were on the best battle dress. And off we went to Purfleet in Essex for the transit camp. And I was introduced then to a few of the troop, but we off the next day by boat to Ostend. When we got to Ostend, the weather, January, just mid-January, was terrible on the continent. It was really cold and everything was frozen. It was really a very bad winter out there. And I was sent as advance party, and we went in jeeps from Ostend. Now, the old wartime jeep had no side doors at all. All you had was a canvas roof over the top, which wasn't used in the summer, but would be in the winter. And we set off from Ostend through Belgium, right down then through Holland. We did stop once at a service canteen for food, but then off we went into Holland, right down into the part where Belgium, Holland and Germany almost meet. Helmond, I think, was the place we went down to. And then waited for the rest of the unit to catch us up a couple of days later. And we were then billeted in houses, or no occupants in them at the time, near to the River Mars. And that was part of our job, was to patrol and keep watch over the River Mars. The other side was, we noticed on the villages there, a church with a steeple, which was obviously an observation post for the Germans. I would imagine they usually use those. But strangely enough, alongside this house we were in was a double glazed greenhouse, which we hadn't seen before. But in the cold even, this was warm. So of course, the lads were always nipping in there to get a bit of warmth. But we rather fancied that they were watching us from the other side of the Mars, because every now and again a mortar bomb would be aimed off in the direction to tell them, or we assumed it was to tell us to get back out of the warmth of the greenhouse. But it never got very vicious, but we did get stonked occasionally by the opposition from the other side of the Mars. And then on one occasion, when the chaps were looking out, they saw movement ahead. All the ground was covered with snow and ice, and this movement stood out black against the white background. So we got a patrol together and went off to investigate this movement of the enemy. But the enemy turned out to be a load of ducks walking on their normal path, so there was no problems with that one. And we stayed there for a little while, and then we moved off to another direction. And if I just give me a moment. Yeah, and then we moved off to take over from one of the army units at a little place called Barlow, which was not too far. We took the 9th Armoured Division had been there, and we relieved them of their particular post, which was again near the Mars, and which included patrolling by the Mars. And then the idea being to help the army by clearing one of their flank positions, so that they were then able to feel that side, the particular flank we were on, was secured for them. And not long to go then, we round in that area for a few days.
What did the clearing of the flank involve?
Well, it was to make sure that there was no enemy on the flank. We patrolled the flank, went through the woods and various other positions that were around there to make sure that there was no enemy immediately in that vicinity, so that the general in charge of the division then, with his staff, was able to work his own plans out without worrying about what was on his particular flanks, because we were sitting there for that job. And that went on for 2 or 3 days. And then we moved to the village of Echt. And we were told then that the next morning we were going into action, that we were actually going to attack the next morning. So we settled down. We were in what we would call an hotel, just lying on the floor and various things. And then I wrote my letter home to tell the family that, you know, this was a change of situation. From previous, we'd been in the war, but this time it would be different. And, you know, with possibility of not returning. And that was written in the village of Eight just before we moved off the next morning. And the next morning we moved off by the units. We had six commando and three commando, who were army commandos, with us in the brigade. 4-6, the Royal Marine Commando, had gone down to Amsterdam for anti-espionage duty. So we moved off with 6 commando, led the way into Masbracht, and cleared Masbracht. And then we went through them down to a little place called Brachtebeek, and that was fairly clear. And A Troop were going to move across open country, and we would move through their lines to their left flank and come in that direction. And as we moved through the lines, I saw their medical orderly. Now, I didn't know their medical orderly and was not, unfortunately, going to know him. But he, we could tell, obviously, by his cap badge and by the fact he had the Red Cross on. And that's all I, at the time, just noticed as we went through. But he, on that day, was to win the Victoria Cross. Now, A Troop had crossed open country and they'd been attacked from a flank with heavy light machine gun, and they'd suffered a fair amount of casualties. And Lance Corporal Harden had gone out, and he'd also brought some of the wounded back. He was then told by his TSM, the Sergeant Major, that he wanted to go again, it was too dangerous. But with 2 Marines to help carry the wounded, he went out again. And this time, unfortunately, he was killed. But we didn't know about that at the time, because we'd moved off onto the left flank, and we were then coming up to take what we call Montfortebeek Stream. There was a gully ahead of us, and Lieutenant Riley and this section were ordered to go ahead of us, the rest of the troop, and see if the gully was clear.
Which troop were you in?
I was in B Troop. Lieutenant Captain Johnny Day was the troop commander, and Lieutenant Riley was in charge of one section, and Lieutenant MacDonald was in charge of the other section. I'd been put in charge of what they call the support group. That included a Bren gun team, a 2-inch mortar team, and riflemen. And our job was to stay with the headquarters of the troop and to operate on the orders of the troop commander to support the other sections if required. So we were, in fact, at the rear of the troop, in that sense, behind the troop commander. Ahead was Lieutenant Riley with his section, and he went into the gully, and we then heard small arms fire, so we knew he contacted the enemy in the gully. they we followed on behind, and then when we got to the gully itself, we found the section had taken control of that particular part of Montfortabeek. So we supported him then, and we stayed there for the rest of the day in the gully with my group. I was again a little behind because we weren't supposed to be engaged in the first instance. We were supposed to be there to support the others, so we actually acted as rear guard, and we watched the rear of the troop position for any action coming that way. But round about 9:30, I suppose it was, at night, there was a counter-attack, and the Germans came down the other side of the gully, so there was a fair amount of shooting going off there, which again, we were just there watching, in a sense. We weren't active, that my particular part was not actively engaged. But it was curious that night, because as I say, the weather was terrible, it was ice and the rest of it, was to hear the light machine gunner on their side and the light machine gunner on our side trying to open their guns again. They had frozen, and they were rattling the bolts of the guns, trying to get them mobile. And it seemed strange then that to hear both sides actively engaged in that particular operation at the time. And it was so cold that they even used the light anti-tank weapon, the PIAT, projector infantry anti-tank, as it was known as, to fire at infantry, which was not normally its purpose, obviously. But that was used on that particular occasion. And they also called up the artillery, but they were so close that the first few rounds that were fired, of course, were really shared amongst the two sides, because they were so close, engaged together. But they did have an effect on the enemy, and with the machine gun fire of our own people and the small arms fire, they did retreat. And it was said that of 40 who came in, a prisoner later on said that 40 of them did the counter-attack and only two were unhurt. And the following morning, there was some 18 dead in front of the position. So they had beaten off quite a severe counter-attack in that particular position. But whilst this was going off, the sergeant of one of the subsections, MacDonald's subsection, was wounded in the leg with a Marine Cresswell. So they were evacuated. And then when we came back out that position the next day, I took over his sergeant subsection that he'd obviously left behind, Sergeant Bain's subsection. And from then on in to the rest of the campaign, I was in charge of that subsection of Marines under Lieutenant MacDonald. But we came back out the day after. We were relieved by 6 Commando. And we then went to a place on the right flank, again to, we were sort of flanking so that the 7th Armoured this time, 7th Armoured Division, would be able to carry out their operations, safe in the knowledge that there was no problem from the flank. And we went to an open space, which was so cold, it was called the ice box. It was really cold. And of course, we had no equipment there, nothing to, apart from Denison smocks, and with no fires. You weren't allowed to have any sort of fires at all. And the ice box was pretty cold. But also, whilst we was in that area, we occupied one of the big houses that was empty, and we'd also been taken from there into Belgium to a coal mine to use their pitted bass, which was quite pleasant that we'd use their bass. And we'd had another operation in that area, which was not too successful from our point of view, when they wanted information about the Germans in a place called Murrum, which was the other side of the River Mars. And from where we were, the River Mars had an island in the middle of it, so it split and went round the idea was that we were, the troop would take the island, and we, B troop, would go through them on, across the island, and we had sledges built to take the boats that we would need to cross the other side of the river. We'd cross the river our side, then we would have sledges to take the boats across to the other side of the island, then we would go across that part of the Mars, go to where the Germans were and secure a prisoner, was the object. But the object needed complete surprise, obviously. But unfortunately, D Troop were the ones that went on to what we call Belle Isle. That was the name we gave it, wasn't its original name. But whilst they were on there, they were surprised, and they had a mortar attack, which rather inflicted fairly heavy casualties. So the operation to go to Murrum was abandoned. But we withdrew from our particular part where we were on the island, withdrew the troops as far as we could, and B Troop then stayed on our bank to watch for enemy following if they were going to counterattack. And we were there, and then a figure came onto the opposite bank in marine uniform, obviously had Dennis and Smock on and the rest, and it turned out to be a sergeant who had been taken prisoner, but he said that the Germans he was with would allow us to come and get one of the wounded Marines and bring him back. So the Captain Day called for the volunteers to go across the river, and half a dozen of us got in the boat. We went across, and as we got across there, we were all in snowsuits, so there was no, very little, you couldn't recognise, very, it'd been night as well. And Johnny Day said to me, "You won't stay with the boat." So I sat down on the bank in the white smock in the snow, holding the rope with the boat just dangling out in the water. And I'm sat there, and suddenly one single shot came between the boat and the bank and flicked, as they do on the films, I've seen them quite often, flicked on the water. And I think that whoever was firing from my flank was saw the boat, and not particularly me, because I was in a snowsuit sitting in on the snow. But I sat there and nothing else happened, just the one shot. Then the boys came back with the wounded, and we got in the boat, and then someone else opened up with a machine gun this time, and wounded one of the party in his hands. And when he was in the boat, he wasn't paddling. So Johnny Day said, "Come on, paddle." And he obviously said, "I can't, sir. I've been wounded." And he was wounded in both arms. And then they fired again, so that helped us to move a little quicker across the River Mars, and we did disembark then and take the wounded back for help. But the sergeant who'd come down was going back, but as there was some gunfire around as well, we weren't sure that he would get back safely in that sense to the Germans. So we hiked him into the boat and brought him back with us, but he himself wouldn't come back. We had to forcibly put him into the boat, but he stayed with the unit after that and carried on through the rest of the campaign. But that particular time, he was quite prepared to go back as a prisoner. But unknown to us, another patrol from one of the other troops had gone at the top of the island after the all the fighting had been done, and they'd found there some dead Germans, one of which was an artillery officer who apparently had been in command of the platoon that was on Belle Isle. On him, they found a map, which did contain most of the positions of the Germans on the other side of the river. So, although the full exercise hadn't gone to plan, they had got what they wanted to know, where the Germans were on the other side, plus they had a prisoner. So, it wasn't a complete failure. And off we went back. Now, from after that, on a personal note, that was the first time I had a Dennis and Smock, because when we'd left Bexhill, everything, what we call war establishment, had been packed away, obviously, because we were leaving that night, and they weren't, I mean, I wasn't there, so everything was packed away, and I was still in battle dress, apart from the snowsuit when we were doing this particular exercise. So somebody, probably one of the dead Marines, forfeited his denizen smock, and it was given to me the next day without knowing who it came from. So I'd had quite a fortnight, 3 weeks there, still in my battle dress top, which was battle dress uniform, which was unusual. But anyway,
what is a denizen smock?
A denizen smock is a parachute smock. They camouflaged, and it's used extensively. It was then by the paras and by the commandos, and it was quite long in a sense, and had quite good pockets for putting bits and pieces in. And we did then, actually, at the back, we opened it up at the back and used that, went across the back of the denizen smock for food and that type of thing. If we wanted to carry a bit of extra, we then put stuff in the back of the there. But it was camouflage, really. That's its purpose. It was a camouflage unit. And in the brigade, we didn't have badges of rank on the denizen smock, partly because the enemy was looking for badges of rank, obviously. But we could be picked out times by the fact most NCOs and officers had Thompson submachine guns as their personal weapon. And there was always the Bren gunner, of course, which was easily to spot. But the idea of not using ranks was to not give help to the snipers. So obviously that's what they would be looking for, the officers and NCOs of the unit. So we didn't wear any badge on that particular one. But that, as I say, from what we heard afterwards, as far as we were concerned, we hadn't been very successful. But by learning later on that somebody had found this dead German officer, it had worked out reasonably well. So we were then, whilst we was in the icebox, we were relieved by the Americans, of all people. But we hadn't seen these before, but the Americans came in, and I think they did a few days later take Rijmegen Bridge, and I think that's Roermond, I think that's what they were looking at. But they came in to relieve us in the icebox, and we packed our kit, and we all had the kit bags, not the kit bags, the rucksacks, the big rucksacks that we had, Bergen, as they were called, Bergen rucksacks. We packed all these, and as well as the kit on a Bergen, you always had either 2-inch mortar bombs or ammunition. Everybody carried a certain amount of extra equipment in that sense. So the Americans saw these and said, "Where are you going?" "Well, we're going back to the station in Rachtebeek with these, about a couple of miles away, I suppose." And we told them, they said, "We've got 5 yards with one of those." But it appeared that when we saw them turn up, about every five men had a truck between them. We had one Jeep between 63 men. And that Jeep was obviously the troop commander's, and to carry extra Bren guns and ammunition, and for recces and all that type of thing. It wasn't necessarily for us. It did seem strange they turned up there, but we went back to the station then, and I was then given the privilege of 48 hours leave in Brussels. So off I went there and spent 48 hours there, and for the first time met the Doodlebugs, which they were aiming at Brussels as well. No damage, but we had quite a pleasant 48 hours there and met the Mannequin Peace statue for the first time, the boy's statue in the just off the Grand Platz there, and went round and managed to buy a few bits of lace that we the ladies showed us how they were making and the what's name, but lace was easy, no weight to bring that, and visited the various places in Brussels before returning back to the station. And we, from the icebox and the station, we went to a place called Ven Rye in Holland, to a monastery for a couple of days and had a rest on there. And we then took over an area of the river, the Maas again, for patrolling, and a fair amount of shelling went off then, and mortar. Mortar was the main weapon that was used against us. And they had also had an 88mm gun, which was very extensively used by the Germans. That had originally been an anti-aircraft gun, but apparently in France, some SS officer had asked the artillery officer why it wasn't used as an artillery piece if the projection could come down low enough to operate. And apparently it had been used, and from then on in, the rest of the campaign, apart from being anti-aircraft, it was also used almost as a piece of artillery. And pretty successful it was too. It was quite a damaging, quite an accurate weapon. And we got fairly stumped with those. And then we were going on to a place, Genup, I think it was called, and we went across what was the longest Bailey Bridge in the world, because that particular ground, by now, the snow had started to thaw, and being Holland, it was obviously covered with water. And this bridge, well, it seemed endless. It went on for quite a long spell. Never seen a bridge as long as that, and that was at Genup. And then we by now we're getting more or less into March, and we had instructions then to move forward again and try and contact the enemy, which we did in open country, and we met the Guards Armoured Division with their tanks, and they had the eye as their symbol on the tanks, and they wanted us to go and have a look, see whether the ground was clear. So we got onto the tanks, and they drove us then round this particular area, and we found that there was no enemy in that particular area, which suited everyone. We did hear later on that our own CO went after we'd been and found a German storeman who'd been left behind, apparently. Whether he was fast asleep, I don't know, but he'd been left behind on this particular area. And then we moved on to another place called Well, which we again did our clearing of the ground ahead of us. But by now we're getting into March, and the bigger river ahead, of course, is the Rhine. So we went back to Ven Rye again, and we were put in B Troop, we were put in a little village called Lunen, which was almost alongside, where we did our training then, using dories and the buffaloes and storm boats, ready for the Rhine. About 8 days we were training there, and then we moved off to a place called Burton, which was a few miles from the Rhine, where we did a bit of work on maps and things like that, because our job, the brigade, was to capture the town of Wesel. So we went through the business of map reading and watching demonstrations of what the other side looked like, and then we moved very close to the Rhine, ready for the Operation Widgeon, as it was called. WIDGEON, that was going to be the operation for crossing the Rhine. And whoever worked the plan out for us did very well. And we had one commando went across, first of all, to secure the bridgehead. Several miles upstream of Wesel was the plan, not to attack the town itself. We went upstream of Wesel. They would then secure that particular ground. Another commando, which was 6, I think, in that instance, would then go through